I'm Chris Sims.
And I'm Todd McKay.
This is the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. We're dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. In this episode, we're going to take a deep dive into judges taking the government to court to try to get pay raises. We have a special interview with the head of the New Zealand Taxpayers Union, kind of our equivalent, about their gun buyback program there. And in Waste Watch, we're going to tell you about a federal minister throwing a big party in Hollywood, costing Canadian taxpayers nearly $10,000.
I found it fascinating to get into New Zealand's gun policy right now. Obviously, it's important to get outside perspective because that's a hot debate here. But first, CBC is reporting that senators have given big pay raises to the chair and vice chair of a committee that does virtually no work. In fact, it only took 9 minutes for this committee to blow through its agenda at its March meeting, and it only meets a few times a year. Yet the Senate quietly gave the chair a bonus of $10,000, and the vice chair got more than $5,000.
You know, any way you slice it, senators already get paid more than $150,000 per year, plus perks. So can we at least explain what this committee even does?
This committee does almost nothing. It just rubber stamps committee membership lists from other committees. Like, this is like some kind of parody sitcom, political comedy show.
It's like, honestly, Yes Minister.
Exactly. I'm not even sure how it took them 9 minutes to do this rubber stamping.
When you actually break it down at an hourly rate, this chair and this vice chair are now making more than heart surgeons. But the Senate really is unbelievable. It's unelected. It's unaccountable. So senators already have a tough time justifying their salaries at all. And you'd think that they would have learned their lesson after Senator Mike Duffy got hammered for his problems with his expense scandal.
Yeah, here's the really infuriating thing. The Senate pretended to learn his lesson, but it was just for show. In 2013, the Senate got rid of these pay hikes for committee after the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We inflated a huge 30-foot-high balloon. May or may not have looked a lot like Mike Duffy. That's open to interpretation. But we sent a message to the Senate. They need to roll back these kind of perks. They did it for a minute, but now they're back at it.
Exactly. It's because we can see them again now. The Senate is really rotten on both sides of the floor when you look at it. Senator Wen Pao Wu is getting the $10,000 raise as this committee's chair. He was appointed by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Senator Carolyn Stewart Olson, she's getting the $5,000 bonus as the vice chair. She was appointed by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Yeah, and that's why the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is fiercely nonpartisan. Every party does stupid things on a pretty regular basis. Mm-hmm. And when they do, we have to hold them accountable. So we've asked our 235,000 supporters to phone the senators taking these raises and give them an earful. We've got their numbers in the show notes if you want to jump into that. Listen, we've made them give up this money before. We've got to do it again.
Exactly. There is one small bright point to this story. Senator Pierre Delfond sent the Canadian Taxpayers Federation a message about this on social media. He opposed these bonuses. In fact, he's opposed any pay bumps for the Senate committee work.
He says that Senate committee chairs and vice chairs should reject these raises because, quote, it would be a small gesture to reduce the Senate's expenses, especially during the pandemic. But more importantly, it would put an end to part of the fear and favor tactics and send a signal of commitment to true reforms. Senator Delfond is absolutely right on this one. Now we just need to make that point to the rest of his Senate colleagues.
Coming up next, Todd is going to take a deep dive and explore why judges are taking the federal government to court to try to get a pay raise with our federal director, Aaron Woodrick, who's also a recovering lawyer. Stay with us.
It's time for our deep dive. This is the part of the show where we get deeper into important issues. And today we're going to get legal on this. We're going to get into the law because we've got a Supreme Court fight that we need to talk about. And happily, we happen to have a lawyer on staff, Aaron Woodrick, our federal director. So Aaron, tell us what we're talking about today.
Well, yes, thanks, Todd. I am a lawyer. I like to say I'm a recovering lawyer, although since the CTF is involved in all these legal cases, it's certainly been coming in handy lately. But I want to talk about a case that we appeared before the Supreme Court in December involving judges' salaries.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to get into a case at the Supreme Court level. Like, that's like getting called up to the NHL when the team's in the Stanley Cup Finals. But listen, this is an important case. Tell us about this.
Well, Todd, you know, it's pretty common sense for most people that you can't, as an employee, you can't force your boss to give you a raise. Now, you can always ask for a raise. You can threaten to leave if you don't get a raise, but you can't go to court and force your boss to give you a pay raise. But that's essentially what happened with judges, with judges in British Columbia, Nova Scotia. It's what they're trying to do, and that could have a pretty big impact for taxpayers across Canada.
Yeah, it's funny. That is a piece of common sense. I think if you and me, if we phoned up our CEO at the Taxpayers Federation, Scott Hennig, and said, listen, Scott, we're going to take you to court if you don't give us a raise, I'm pretty sure he'd laugh at us. Like, I'm pretty sure that's what would happen. So how in the world did these judges get all the way to the Supreme Court by trying to argue that they can force the government to give them a raise?
Well, here's what happened. So unlike most other government employees, judges' salaries are usually based on a recommendation from an independent committee that's arm's length from government. And that's because we want to keep judges independent from political pressure.
Okay, so I can see a little bit of logic here. We don't want politicians docking judges' pay or giving them bonuses, depending on what kind of verdict they bring forward. At the end of the day, our justice system certainly isn't perfect, but we want judges basing decisions on the law, not on political whims. So tell us a little bit about these committees. How do these work?
Well, they're independent committees. They're made up of lay people and in some cases lawyers. And what they do is they look at the general rate of inflation, average increases for pay for government workers. And then they make a recommendation for pay changes based on that. And usually what happens is the government says, okay, and they just give judges the pay raise. But what was unusual here is that recently in both BC and Nova Scotia, the committee recommended some pretty substantial pay hikes for the judges, even though both of those provincial governments were implementing across-the-board spending cuts. So the governments refused to give them their raises, and the judges then took them to court.
Okay. So just to recap here, the British Columbia and Nova Scotia governments told everybody in the government, across the board, got to tighten our belts, money's tight, everybody's got to take a little bit less. But the judges just said, nope, that doesn't apply to us, we want big-time raises. And the judges are basically saying there that those committee recommendations, those should be automatic. They're more important than what democratically elected officials think. And then they take the government to court. Am I getting this about right?
It's about right. And I mean, really, that what the judges are alleging is that the governments were flexing their muscles and essentially singling out and punishing judges. And of course, the whole situation is extra awkward because it's judges that are taking the government to court, and who's going to have to rule on it other than judges?
Yeah, that's getting all kinds of awkward. All right, I don't want you all full lawyer on us here, but boil down the arguments. What did we tell the court when we jumped into this?
Well, basically our argument is that at the end of the day, decisions about spending have to be made by people that we can hold accountable. In other words, elected officials, politicians, the government. Furthermore, while a government wouldn't be allowed to say, for example, that everyone's getting a raise except judges, because that would clearly show that they're picking on judges, wherever a government can show that it's actually imposing across-the-board spending restraint, that should be enough evidence to prove that they're not singling out judges specifically. Or if you want to take the legalese from our official submission, quote, limiting the increase in judicial remuneration will be prima facie justified if it is consistent with a broader policy of expenditure control. But the reverse of that, of course, also has to be true. If they're making cuts across the board or holding the line on salaries everywhere else across government, then judges don't have a right to be singled out and treated specially.
I think the Latin content of our podcast just went way up. Okay, but listen, these are important arguments. And the Canadian Taxpayers Federation were the only non-government organization that showed up to the Supreme Court to make those arguments. And there's an important principle here. This is about much more than just judges' salary. Taxpayers have a huge interest in this issue overall. Tell us about the principle we're defending here.
Well, the real concern beyond the judges' pay themselves is that there's a legal precedent at stake. It would be a very dangerous precedent for the court to essentially say governments can't refuse to give pay raises to any of their employees. You can probably imagine that government unions would be salivating at the possibility that they could use the courts to force governments into hiking bureaucrat salaries, even in cases where voters have elected politicians to reduce spending. So, you know, the basic point is that elected officials have to be responsible to the taxpayers who elected them, and that includes making decisions about the salaries of people who are being paid out of taxpayer money. And that's really the reason why we intervened to stand up for taxpayers on this. And the funniest part of all, actually, to me, is that the judges' associations know that that argument's very bad for them. And that's actually why they tried to keep us out of the case by asking the Supreme Court not to let us be interveners in the case.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty funny that the judges' association didn't want us there. Like, not so much like ha ha funny, but more like this milk smells funny. That kind of funny. Explain how the judges' association tried to block taxpayers and keep us out of this case completely.
Well, procedurally, if you want to intervene in a case, the people who are already in the case, the parties in the case, can either support potential interveners, oppose them, or take no position. And then the court just decides, partly based on whether other parties are supporting them. The judges' associations in this case opposed us. In fact, they actually said that the CTF was, quote, seeking to mask a real and inappropriate agenda, which I guess is code, in their words, for us pointing out that governments only have so much money to go around. Anyway, the judges in the case did not succeed. The Supreme Court judges let us in. And in fact, I remember at the hearing, one of the lawyers for the judges' associations half jokingly told our lawyer in court that, quote, I guess I couldn't keep you guys out.
So we got through the lawyers on the other side, even though they were trying to block us. You were there when we were in the Supreme Court. You were in those Stanley Cup finals. How'd it go?
It went really well. And I mean, first and foremost, our supporters came through in a big way. You know, we had to pay for this case. We had a great lawyer, a guy named Adam Goldenberg, who's with the firm McCarthy Tetro in Toronto. Now, Adam's he's a believer in the cause here. So he gave us a pretty good deal, a really good rate for what would normally cost. But it still wasn't nothing. We had to pay for it. And hundreds of our supporters chipped in with some donations to cover the legal bills. And look, because interveners are just groups or individuals that can join in the court case, you know, we only get a few minutes up there. We only get 5 minutes. Adam managed to squeeze 8 minutes out of them, and he made some very key points in that time. And look, as I already said, the Judges Association didn't want us there, but I think that we made a real impact in the case, you know, far more than an intervener usually does. And now we're just waiting to see a decision from the judges.
Well, it's good that somebody's there to stand up for taxpayers. You have to have those arguments raised at very least. So what happens next?
Well, we're waiting. I mean, normally it takes 4 to 6 months to get a decision to come down. But of course, we're in the middle of a very strange crisis, so we don't know how that's going to affect things. So we're still waiting, and hopefully soon we'll get a result and be sure to share it with all our supporters.
Yeah, and there's another element to this. The fact that we got into the Supreme Court is really important for reasons beyond this specific case. It's a really good warm-up for us because we're going to be back in the Supreme Court in September to fight the Trudeau carbon tax. And once again, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is the only non-government organization showing up to fight for taxpayers. There are tons of lawyers on the other side representing dozens of groups like the David Suzuki Foundation. They're fighting in favor of a carbon tax. We're one of the only ones showing up to fight it. But if you want to see more about our work on the judges' pay issue, check out the link to the video of Adam's submission, our lawyer's submission. It's about 8 minutes long. And he makes some good arguments. One last thing, Aaron, can you guarantee we're going to win this case? You can guarantee it, right? Go out on a limb here.
Hey, the first thing they teach you in law school is to never guarantee anything. So I'm optimistic. We'll have to see. But as I said, I'm really confident in Adam's submission, and I know we certainly made an impression. The bottom line, though, of course, is that you know, even in court, taxpayers need someone to stand up for them. In this case, the Supreme Court, and we were very very pleased to be there. We're very proud to take that stand because we know in a lot of cases, if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it.
Hi, I'm Scott Hennig, president of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Sorry for interrupting the podcast, but I wanted to take a few seconds of your time to tell you more about the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We are 235,000 Canadians from coast to coast that are fed up. We are fed up with politicians taking too much out of our paychecks, often to waste it on a bunch of pet projects, corporate welfare, and pork barreling to buy votes. We organize campaigns to push back on these politicians. These campaigns often include petition drives, billboards, media stunts, and more. But most importantly, they ask our supporters to pitch in and take action. Alone, we're a voice in the wilderness. Together, we're an army to be reckoned with. You can join the fight and sign up at no cost at taxpayer.com. That website again is taxpayer.com. Okay, now back to the podcast.
It's time for Waste Watch. This is when we make fun of the dumb things that governments are spending your money on. Todd, what do you have for us today?
You know, when you think of places that need help, that could use a hand up, I don't know that we often think of Hollywood. Like, does Hollywood need help, you know, putting together a little party?
Yeah, I don't think that red carpet galas qualify as essential services, no.
And yet, taxpayers got billed for putting on a fancy party in Hollywood. Ottawa spent almost $10,000 on a premiere party for the show called Mary Kills People back in 2017, according to documents that we dug up exclusively here under the Access to Information Act.
I don't think I've ever seen that show.
I don't think a lot of people have seen that show. So Global made the show. It's about a nurse who euthanizes patients. It didn't last for very long, though. It did get picked up briefly by the American network Lifetime, but Lifetime dropped it before it even aired its third season. But Global Affairs Canada spent just about $10,000 to put together a fancy Hollywood premiere party for the show. And coincidentally, I'm sure this was just a happy coincidence, Minister Melanie Jolie, the heritage minister at the time, just happened to be in town for the party.
What a glittering use of taxpayers' money, a Hollywood party. You know, who cares about roads and bridges and schools and stuff? Let's get some wine and some cheese I probably can't pronounce and go with the hobnobbers in Los Angeles and have a big party. You know, when you think about it, it's really yet another event that's been put on by the Mission Cultural Fund. For listeners who don't remember what the Mission Cultural Fund is, that is the same funding source, your money, that used $17,000 to fly a Canadian chef to India to make Indian food with Prime Minister Trudeau during his trip there. Gotta ask though, what value did this premiere party in Hollywood provide for taxpayers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, Hollywood's famous for parties. I don't know that they needed our help to put on a fancy show, and yet our taxpayers had to pay for it. On the records for the event, the party is described as, quote, trade facilitation. So there's lots of photos there where the minister is hanging out with very expensively dressed celebrity kind of people in the consul's backyard there in LA. What kind of trade work was happening there? That's it's a little hard to see that in the photos.
They were trading our money for fancy wine and cheese, probably. You know, given that the show was picked up and then promptly dropped by Lifetime, I kind of feel like the trade facilitation side of things may not have been very successful.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's obviously a big red flag right there. But aside from the policy issues, there's a simple management problem here. So yeah. I think for most of us, if you got a budget to put on a party and somebody said, listen, put on a party, just don't spend more than $7,500. I think most of us would be like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I can pull that off. $7,500 is a lot of money for a party. In this case, that was the budget for this party, $7,500, which is already a crazy high amount. But they blew that budget, went way over, spent almost 10 grand. And that's a huge pattern in this fund. It's been millions of dollars over budget year after year. It's totally unacceptable. And Global Affairs, we asked for a comment from them. Somehow, they didn't have time to get back to us. The LA consulate who put on this show, they didn't have time to chat either. It's a real mystery why they don't want to talk about this.
That's disappointing. When you look at the documents, the spending documents of this group, this fund, the Mission Cultural Fund, is really nothing more than a pot of money that the federal government uses to waste outside of Canada's borders. If people want to know more about this, they can check out the show notes or go to our website, taxpayer.com. They can read the full story there.
Today we're joined by Jordan Williams. Now he's the executive director of the New Zealand Taxpayers Union. So his job in New Zealand is similar to what we do in Canada. We look out for taxpayers. Now the reason we asked you to join us today is because New Zealand is about a year ahead of Canada in a process that we just started, a massive program to ban and buy back thousands of guns. Tell us why that happened in New Zealand and tell us a little bit about how that policy was implemented by the government there.
Well, it came in quite rapidly after a tragic event on 15 March 2019, where 51 people were slaughtered in the Christchurch terrorist attack. It was an Australian nutter who had come to New Zealand, had got a firearms license, and had a whole lot of, including a number of illegal firearms, and live streamed this terrible event. And that was on 15 March. By 11 April, Parliament had passed it was nearly unanimous, there was only one vote against it, 119 to 1, a ban on semi-automatics and what politicians like to call military style, which actually, once you get down to it, it's very hard to define.
Describe the policy a little bit in New Zealand. What did it look like? How did it roll out?
Well, basically overnight, banned a huge number of firearms people mostly had for practical purposes. I mean, unlike the US, I don't know what it's like in Canada, most firearms owners have it for a practical purpose, which is mostly either pest control or hunting. There are a lot of sports shooting clubs, but for example, New Zealand does not have that pistol shooting culture. I mean, they just, the most popular firearm in New Zealand is probably the 303, you know, post-World, a lot of soldiers brought it back after the Second World War and used for, we don't have moose, but we hunt a lot of red deer. And of course, most kids growing up on rural properties would be given a bunny gun at their 14th birthday for shooting rabbits or possums. Possums are an Australian pest. Myself, I'm one of the 250,000 New Zealanders who own or have a firearms license. I've got a little 17 HMR for shooting wallabies and possums. Wallabies are also a pest in a couple of areas of New Zealand. But my point is that for most New Zealanders that this affected, it would be the likes of a 22 semi-automatic that can hold 10 rounds. You know, that's now banned. Similarly, the next in line is probably going to be bolt-action shotguns. But, for example, if you had a semi-automatic shotgun for duck shooting, which is a big sport here, you were probably affected because of the size of the magazine. And what the government did is said, all right, all of those are banned, and you've got to hand them into the police, and we'll compensate you, and you've got until the end of the year. Now, what that led to is actually when you went down into the detail, it was not the fair compensation that Jacinda Ardern had promised. Because when you look at the sort of upper limit, if your firearm was brand new, the government would pay you no more than about 90% of the wholesale price. And from a taxpayer's perspective, the irony is, because the government had really, really sort of gone cheap in the compensation area, it led to a heck of a lot of resentment, particularly for sort of firearms of historic value that were on the schedules considered old and of very low value. Whereas the Australian model, instead of using wholesale prices and deducting, say, 50% if it's had a bit of wear and tear, they were quite generous. In fact, I think they were paid about 110% of retail if something was brand new. Now, from a taxpayer's perspective, the taxpayers' union wasn't out there saying you should be paying more, but certainly it was something that we talked a lot internally here at the taxpayers' union, that actually what the government's trying to do isn't going to work, because the amount of resentment in the firearms community is, okay, everyone understood that this terrible event, there probably had to be some sort of political reaction to it. But when you see Jacinda Ardern on the cover of Time magazine and The Guardian in the UK and all the left media around the world fawning over her response to the Christchurch massacre, in actual fact, New Zealand firearms owners felt under attack, that their way of life, their lifestyle, their hobbies were not at all understood or respected by our Labor Party or centre-left government, the leading party in particular. And what it's led to, which is such a great shame, is a heck of a lot. And this is totally anecdotal, but it seems that the key advantage New Zealand had in the area of firearms law, and that is very, very high compliance rates. You know, it'd be difficult to find anyone with a firearm that didn't have a firearms license. And there's historically been quite a lot of trust between the police and the firearms owning community. Well, that's pretty much gone now. There's a lot of resentment towards the police, firstly, from the firearms community for the way that this was so suddenly politicised and it turned into a bit of a Punch and Judy show to the licensed firearms owners and law-abiding licensed firearms owners. And what we're sadly starting to see now is a real erosion of that. I mean, again, anecdotal, but our big hardware companies, apparently they noticed quite an uptake in sales of short-run PVC piping. And what that was people burying their granddad's firearm that was now banned in the backyard.
Yeah, and certainly that concept of government being accountable to the people and working with the people rather than against them, I think that's an important part of the Canadian conversation as well, especially given that some of those definitions that you were alluding to, how do you define some of these specific firearms? In the Canadian context, some semi-automatic center fires are being banned, others aren't. So it creates a real sense of resentment across the board. But let's go to your point and to the taxpayers' point. How much does this actually cost New Zealand taxpayers?
Well, about just shy of $100 million went out the door for the buyback. We didn't criticise that per se because arguably the bigger problem is that because the government was being cheap, the compliance was probably quite low. The big uncertainty we're dealing with is the government does not know how many firearms are actually in the New Zealand community. I mentioned that we have very good legal compliance in that licensed firearm owners, most people that own a firearm, and if you trade a firearm, even sort of in rural communities, private sales through the equivalent of Amazon sort of thing, people look for the licenses and require that to show me your license. Well, we don't have a central register of the firearms. And frankly, the government just didn't go and do the homework, go back to customs data. You know, there's not a heck of a lot of leakage across the New Zealand border because you may have noticed if you look at the world map, we've got quite a big moat around us. And it shouldn't have been that difficult to come up with estimates of where the actual number is. But the best we have is that there is somewhere between 55,000 and 240,000 firearms of the particular classes that were newly banned. So between 55 and 240,000. So the buyback resulted in 61,000, very close to the low end of that estimate, being handed in. Officials will privately acknowledge that there is a heck of a lot still out there that are now legal, that probably that a very low proportion of those would be owned by what you and I would consider are criminal, although they are now. But now we have the problem of all sorts of a huge volume of these now illegal firearms that are illegal firearms, and we'll see in the years to come that earlier compliance I mentioned and everything being done in the open is suddenly going to be done on a black market. So that's I think that's terribly sad. The other big explosion we've seen, and I think in hindsight, I think most parliamentarians would acknowledge this now, as we left it up to the police to come up with the policy in this area rather than just enforce the law and run the administration around this. And not only was that poor, and I'll come back to that in a moment, it was very expensive. It went from 18 to about $35 million in the costs of regulating this particular area, and that's just pen pushers here in Wellington.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of problems there, a lot of concerns. To kind of recap where you're coming from and to give some perspective to the Canadian context, you know, we're looking at well over $100 million in costs in New Zealand already for this. But New Zealand has about 5 million people. Canada has about 38 million people. I suspect we probably even have a few more guns than New Zealanders do, just given our culture and how many hunters we have and that sort of thing here. If it costs $100 million for New Zealand, it's likely to be six or seven times that in Canada, even if you make allowances for the different types of guns that are being captured in each policy. The cost for this is extraordinary.
Back of the envelope, I think it's about 2 billion Canadian. I mean, the New Zealand Canadian dollar are very similar in value. Back of the envelope, assuming you the scope of the bans are about the same as ours, because that's the real issue. It's not the number of firearms owners, it's the number of firearms that are banned. And assuming that we've got about 250,000 firearms, licensed firearms owners here. But I'd be very surprised if Canada gets away with it costing $2 billion. But the thing is, go back to my point earlier, we did it on the cheap. If you want it to actually be successful, you probably want to pay $3 billion. And then the question is that $3 billion worth it for what you get in return?
Yes, exactly. And that's a huge point that I want to get to in just a moment. But I do want to talk to you about where the policy debate is going now. So with the Canadian debate, the government brought this policy forward to ban and buy back a lot of guns, but it's saying that it's going to have more legislation down the road. We don't know what that's going to look like. In New Zealand, you're having a heated debate about the gun registry. And of course, we have a lot of history with that in Canada. When they first brought it here in the 90s, they said it was going to cost $2 million. The actual bill came in at north of $2 billion, an incredible amount of money, absolutely damning indictments by the Auditor General at multiple points, to the point where the government reversed itself, got rid of the gun registry. And even after that government changed, the current government has not brought back the gun registry. I think that's a pretty clear admission that it was a bad policy and one that didn't work. But this is one of the issues. If you start moving down a path where it's not evidence-based, you're spending a lot of money disconnected from the evidence of making things safer, that road goes to very expensive places. And I suspect that that's one of the concerns that you have when you look at the future in New Zealand.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is very saddening that our Prime Minister, who in a lot of ways models herself on your Prime Minister, has tried to lead us into a American-style them and us, frame the firearms community as sort of American NRA-style nutters. But it hasn't really worked. And one of the things she promised in the immediate aftermath was, okay, they've done all these bans, and she got all this wonderful press coverage around the world for that. And then it was the promise for this second tranche, this register, to be passed by Parliament by the end of last year. But one of her supporting or coalition partners that is sort of the popularist party in the middle, they hold the balance of power under our weird electoral system. But they appear to have been the handbrake on it. And then, of course, you've had all these other, there's been a couple of examples of leaks of information, for example, and it's been a little bit of a headache. Now, I don't think they'd ever acknowledge this, but the fact that it's no longer being talked about. The bill is sitting, it's been through select committee and sitting on the order paper and hasn't gone anywhere. Then COVID came along. I predict, can't be too confident, but I think that it's likely to languish on the order paper until the election. And I suspect a year ago they were going to hold this up as some great success for the government, when actually now it hasn't been. I mean, the key question though is has it been worthwhile? And the Auditor General released a report in the last few weeks on that question, and it was around nothing to do with the register or this new bill. Obviously, that's not the policy issues aren't the role of the Auditor General, but the implementation and the spending of money is. And he tasked himself with the issue of this firearms buyback. And happy to go into that.
Yeah, for sure. Tell us about that. What did? How did the implementation actually go? It's one thing to say you're going to do it. Governments love to put out the press release, but when they actually have to do it, oftentimes things look differently. How did the operation go?
Well, I mean, as you know, an Auditor General is outside the political fray, so doesn't sort of he's tempered with his comments. But I think the key conclusion was that there's no evidence that the money will actually result in a safer community. And this is this is something that the Taxpayers Union, or the equivalent of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, can say, hang on, you guys spent $100 million buying back these firearms only to destroy them, often in front of the owner. You've doubled the amount of administration costs, give or take about $35 million. And you, after having thoroughly gone through everything, the Auditor General can't point to any evidence that this makes us safer. And isn't that the whole basis of what's going on? Like that led us to here. Now, there's a Royal Commission, or what used to be known as a Royal Commission, we now call it a government inquiry, into the Christchurch massacre. The firearms community would say, well, hang on, wait until that we have that before you go ahead with this second tranche. However, I mean, what will be fascinating in that is that's going to be the first thing that the first time the what I think are far greater questions around how this Australian nutter was issued with a New Zealand firearms license, and how on earth the background checks, which clearly weren't done properly to identify this guy based on what's in the media, that should have been flashing red lights, but instead the police issued him a firearms license as the test in the New Zealand legislation is that you are quote, fit and proper person, close quote, to be issued with a firearms license. And I mean, for when I got mine about 10 years ago, but they go and, you know, they interviewed my girlfriend, took her into another, you know, they came round to home and checked me out, sort of sized me up, and wanted to talk to the people I lived with, my flatmates and my girlfriend, you know, by themselves, which is, you know, just the way that you should do it. And they sort of, and it was quite informal, but they were sort of figuring you out, and you have to do an evening at the police station where it's the Mountain Safety Council give you some lectures and stuff, and you have to sit a little test like you do for the driver's license at the end, and there's a policeman in there, and no doubt that's just sizing everyone up. You know, that it's very difficult to put this stuff down into legislation, you know, the precisely what those tests are, because it does necessarily rely on a degree of judgment. But it seems that those basic steps that I went through 10 years ago have actually been watered down over recent years. And I hope that the Royal Commission turns itself to that, because as a New Zealander, I feel a heck of a lot safer with those sorts of things than the government trying to create bureaucratic rules as to who is suitable and who isn't, or try to invent very strange legal definitions of what is quote unquote a military style weapon.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's somewhat similar to the Canadian context. We have gun licensing here. You have to take a course. Usually it happens at your local, you know, Legion Hall kind of thing. And there's an old fella who's been hunting for 30 years, kind of looking you up and down before he signs off on the test. That's a big part of it. But listen, I trust that old fella knows who should be owning a gun better than just about anybody else. And it's an interesting way of doing it. Unfortunately, in the Canadian context, with the tragedy that we had in Nova Scotia, where more than 20 people were killed recently, and that caused a lot of this policy debate in Canada. that individual did not have a gun license. He had run in with the law earlier. In Canada, if you have a criminal record, your odds of getting a gun license are understandably and necessarily low. He had a criminal record, did not have a gun license, and was still able to get guns illegally. We don't have all of the details of that yet, but unlike New Zealand, we have no moat. This is not an island. Canada has the longest undefended border in the world, and our neighbors to the south are lovely on many fronts, but they like guns quite a bit. There are a lot of guns in America, and it's not difficult for criminals in Canada to skip across the border to the south, pick up some guns, and bring them back into Canada. So I want to move that discussion with you to the New Zealand context. How is the policy working in New Zealand in terms of stopping illegal guns and in stopping criminals from getting guns? Because ultimately, most gun crimes are by definition committed by criminals, and most criminals have illegal guns. If we want to make things safer, it strikes me that dealing with that end of the equation is a big part of it. Tell me about how that's working in New Zealand.
Our big problem around firearms is actually around gangs. The what used to be the, when it was the baby boomers, it was the bikie gangs, but are now just the criminal gangs. At least what seems to hit the news of firearms being pulled on police officers is usually gang-related. And what is clear is that this, in the last 12 to 18 months, this whole focus on it's been the wrong end. It's been all the law-abiding ones, because let me assure you that those gang headquarters aren't being cleared out of firearms to march down to the police station to hand them in as part of the buyback. And this is the point from the licensed firearms community, which is, why are you giving us a hard time? You know, it's not, I deliberately use the term that this shooter was an Australian. You know, he was an outsider, was seriously wacko. He'd travelled around the world sort of meeting various groups. As I say, there was lots of warning signs with this guy. So it seems it's understandable that members of the firearms community are upset that, hang on, the attention has been taken off the people that are, you know, that are the crooks or the gang members, and being put on to, you know, Joe, firearm owner, who has a semi-automatic shotgun and likes to go duck shooting every May. You know, that is bizarre from a value for money perspective. And what for? A theme that runs through that Auditor General's report is that all of this money came from, particularly the admin money, has come from what the police's actual job is, which is to catch the crooks. And I would argue that if you've got a family heirloom that has sat in your gun safe for 60 years from granddad or your dad or whatever, that you occasionally use to shoot possums or teach your kids how to shoot, I venture to suggest that the police should not be wasting our taxpayer money coming after you.
Well, and that takes it to an important point about choices. And that comes down to value for taxpayers, which is a huge thing for you, a huge thing for us. It's not just about the money. If you're going to spend the money, you need to spend it on the best possible outcome. We looked at it, even if you accept the government's projections here in Canada that this will only cost $200 million, I think that's obviously very low end. But even if you look at those hundreds of millions, you can hire a lot of police officers to go after gang members. There's lots of things you could do with the money that's better than buying your grandpa's gun and putting it through a press and destroying it. It won't make people safer.
It's a symptom of an increasing rural-urban divide that we see across the Western world, and probably more so in countries like Canada and New Zealand, which are traditionally more rural based. You know, I'm sitting here in CBD Wellington, about 200 metres from our Parliament buildings. The the man in the street, or the here it will be the bureaucrat in the street, versus the opinion in my hometown, which is a province that's economy is largely based on growing apples and pears, and now wine, that it would be very, very different. There's a real sort of them and us, or almost sort of intellectual snobbery towards the lifestyle and values of probably what the supporters of groups like the Taxpayers Union and the Taxpayers Federation have, that are based and still connected into those rural communities. I mean, something I asked our staff here, we've got about 10 on staff at the moment, and about half of them are part-time student interns at university, a lot of law students and economics or finance. And I asked them, when's duck shooting open? Now, there'd be very few rural New Zealanders that wouldn't know that duck shooting opens the first Saturday of May. But they didn't know. These kids didn't know. And that's because they're mostly from the cities. And this is New Zealand. You know, we've got more sheep than we do people.
Yeah, you're quite right. There's certainly a significant divide in Canada. So I'm talking today from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. That's as far as anybody in Toronto or Ottawa in the middle of Canada is concerned. I live in the middle of nowhere. It's a very different point of view. There's a huge divide here in terms of understanding. I think that's a reason that it's important to have groups like the Taxpayers Union in New Zealand and the Taxpayers Federation in Canada to give voice to some of these concerns and make sure that we're not bringing forward knee-jerk reactions that cost taxpayers a lot of money, but rather we focus on policies that actually work and respect the taxes that people pay in. And hey, you know what? You're just starting your day there. You've got a lot going on. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you, Todd. And can I just say that from the other side of the world, we look very closely at what the Taxpayers Federation does, and have actually modelled. We're a lot younger than you. We're only 6 years old. But we looked at the way the Canadian Taxpayers Federation were the voice for taxpayers in the corridors of power. And if our organisation, when it is your age, is half as effective as yours, I'll be very proud indeed. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast. You know, Todd, that interview with New Zealand taxpayers was super interesting.
Yeah, you know, it was fun. I don't know what a Punch and Judy show is. I feel like it's not good. I don't think you meant it as a compliment, but fun. And also really instructive to hear from a country that has so much shared heritage with Canada and how it's going on a policy that, boy, we've got questions about here. So yeah, that was fun. For all of you, thank you so much for listening to the show. I want to give a special thanks to James Wood for editing the podcast, for digging into documents again. Appreciate all his work on that. For all of you, please subscribe to the show. Don't just listen to it. Subscribe to it. Let's get to know each other. Also, give us some reviews. We want to make the show better. We know there's ways to do that. But we need suggestions from you, so please review the show. More than anything, though, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Scott Hennig, president of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. If you've got another minute, I'd like to ask you to think about the one person you know that would really enjoy listening to this podcast. Do us a favor and do them a favor and send them a quick note to let them know about it. At the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, we believe there is power in numbers. That's why we've worked so hard to build an army of taxpayers who are ready to push back. And we did it because people like you shared our work with that one person that they knew would really appreciate taking part. Thanks for listening, and thanks for doing your part to make Canada a better place.